Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Robert Rice was Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton and economic advisor to President Obama. He is the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley, author of 13 books, including Beyond Outrage, The Work of Nations, and Aftershock, subtitle The Next Economy and America's Future, which is the basis of a movie in which Robert Rice is the main character. I guess the presenter is probably more accurate. That's called Inequality for All. Really, this is the truth. Rice is one of the strongest presenters I have ever seen in the media. I've seen him on CNN, I've seen him on CNBC, and in his previous appearance on this radio program. So it is a special pleasure, Bob Rice, to welcome you back to Work with Marty Nemko.
Well, thank you, Marty. Keep your expectations low for this interview, will you please? Right. You just built me up. I have no place to go but failure right now.
Well, very good. Well, I will lower my expectations. Good. I will follow you. Okay, so this show focuses on work, and while we're going to spend most of our conversation about policy issues related to work, I thought it'd be valuable to our listeners to hear a bit about any work-life lessons that you've learned from your own personal experiences. Was there a first moment in your life that taught you an important life lesson related to work or your career?
Well, you know, I've had a lot of jobs in the private sector as well as the public sector. My first job did teach me a very important lesson. I got a job on Madison Avenue in a little advertising agency. Huh. Really,
this was ironic and wonderful to hear.
Yeah, this is Mad Men, right?
Yeah.
And it was around the same era as Mad Men, but my job was being a gopher,
you know, gopher, right? Of course,
yeah, gopher coffee. Right. And I also had charge. I was in charge of the boss's dog, which meant that I ended up spending a fair amount of time scraping the dog's. Well, there's no better way of saying it, doo-doo, off
right.
of the tar paper top of the roof of the 42nd floor of a building. And
talk
you know
about
what
a
that taught
job.
Me? No, you know what? Crappy job. It taught me humility. You know, I thought I was a pretty, you know,
capable guy.
And I may have been capable, but, you know, I had to get used to being a gopher. And you have to. In life, in work, you've got to sometimes swallow your pride and you've got to say, well, you know, I'm not the greatest thing since sliced bread.
I agree. And frankly, every successful person I've spoken to had some experience like that. I drove not that I'm famous, but I drove a New York City cab when I was in college, and that was very helpful. My first job was at 12 years old, believe it or not, writing garnishee notices for a furniture store in Harlem.
Well, let me top that.
Good.
Because I worked in Robert Kennedy's Senate office, and that was, you know, talk about...
Well, that's big.
Talk about big.
Yeah.
But my job
yeah.
was I was in charge of the signature machine.
The automatic signing.
The automatic signing. So I just had to make sure that the, you know, his letterheads and his letters, you know, the actual paper was put in correctly, and that the letters that came from his staff of secretaries were all properly
right.
aligned so that this big signature machine, in those days it was a big, you know, pen on the end of a big wooden handle, would do the right thing. And I did that, I think it must have been... maybe 3 months, four months. That's all I did. And I was, well, I got so bored that I used to send letters to my friends with his signature. You know, dear Mr. Dworkin, congratulations on having the largest nose in New York State. You know, things like that. That people still have those. But here's what I learned. One day, the senator, Robert Kennedy, came out of a bank of elevators, and I didn't think he knew who I was. I mean, I had not met him. I just ran his signature machine. But he looked at me. And he was surrounded by these top aides, you know, everybody talking to him. And he looked at me, and he said, "How are you, Bob?"
Mm.
"How are you, Bob?"
Mm-hmm.
He said that to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he
knew your name.
My
yeah.
name
yeah.
made all the difference. I was ready to do that signature machine for the next 5 years.
I have the yang for that yin story about my daughter. My daughter's, her dream when she, you know, I'm a career counselor, so she's a junior at UCLA. And I say, okay, Amy, it's time to decide what's your dream job. I want to work for Hillary Clinton. Long story short, she gets a job in Hillary Clinton, but what's her job? Answering letters to Socks the cat.
So, now, did she have to be Socks the Cat and answering the letters?
With her automatic
Socks,
signature,
yes.
with a paw print.
Right? Yeah.
So, but of course, I'm back in California, eager to hear about her first day. She called me. So, Amy, what'd you do? She told me the Socks the Cat thing. I said, you know, I'm the career counselor, so I can't tolerate 3 months of that like you have to. So I say to her, Amy, talk to your boss. Your boss is not Hillary. It was Evelyn Lieberman, who was the chief of staff. And I say, tell her that, of course, you're willing to pay your dues, but that you're a pretty good writer, and if by any chance there's any opportunity to do any writing, you'd be honored to do that. Well, 3 or 4 days later, the person who was her researcher went on maternity leave, and Evelyn Lieberman came to my daughter and had my daughter try out as writing Hillary's daily briefing, and she stayed up all night to research the Sultan of Oman.
Well, that's a slight... a difference from Socks the Cat.
Yeah.
So did she, when she did the briefing, did she sign it, Socks the Cat?
Anyway, the punch, but the lesson, because this shows, again, is about career and lessons. The lesson, of course, is ask for what you want, but with humility. And here is the punchline. You talked about Robert Kennedy saying, hi, Bob. Amy did get to meet Hillary on occasion, but after 13 months of doing her daily briefing, which was a very important role, you know, she was feeling guilty. We were still supporting. We supported her all through college. We were supporting her 13 months. She wasn't getting paid. So she went to Hillary and said, you know, it's an honor to work for you, but I would really love to get paid. I'm guilty that my parents supported me. And, you know, this is the most shocking than ever, probably ever I've heard in my life. Hillary stiffened, and she looked at Amy and said, you should be so lucky to be working for me. And my daughter quit. You know, here she was, somebody who champions raising the minimum wage, treating workers well, and in private, that's what Hillary did. So there was a difference between Robert Kennedy and Hillary Clinton.
Well, Robert Kennedy, actually, he found out that I was, while I was doing the signature machine, 2 months later, I was coordinating an anti-Vietnam War petition signed by every young person on the Hill, on Capitol Hill, and I thought he'd be thrilled, and he brought me into his office. And he said, I understand you're the organizer, one of the two organizers of this anti-war petition. And I smiled and I said, yes, Senator. You know, it fits your position.
Right.
And he said, cease.
Wow.
And I said, why? He said, take your name off this. I don't want to be associated with this. I don't want anybody to trace it back. I'm having enough trouble with that blankety-blank Lyndon Johnson as it is without adding to your, you know, this your efforts. And now you can leave my office. So, not fired, but right. You can leave my... So it's, you know, a little humility and everything else in those early jobs is critically important.
Everything is nuance, you know. How much self-starterness should you demonstrate? How much do you need to ask your boss? Everything is complicated. And even great guys can make inadvertent mistakes.
Well, it's also knowing yourself well enough to know that when you are... with my students, I call it personality drugs. You know, everybody has a set of personality drugs. One personality drugs is you want to be in control, or you want to be loved, or you want to, you want others to feel like you are the most brilliant thing since whatever. And whatever that drug is, you've got to be aware of it because it's going to get in your way.
Good point.
Sometime, somehow, and you've got to, you know. Unless you're willing to spend $100,000 on psychotherapy, you're not going to get rid of it.
Right.
But you need to be aware of it, just aware of it, enough so it doesn't bring you down.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemko. Special guest, Robert Reich. We will be talking about work-related policy, but there are lessons about career and life that are embedded in people's stories, and we've been kind of trading stories about that. But let's turn now. Let's turn to policy. This show does focus on work. So... your book, Aftershock, and its derivative movie, Inequality for All, argues that income inequality is going to hurt society more than even most people realize. Flesh that out for us.
Well, it's already hurting. One of the reasons that this economy is experiencing such a slow, almost a record slow recovery, an anemic recovery, is because so much of the economic gains have gone to the very top. So the vast middle class and poor do not have the purchasing power they need to get the economy going. The rich, they don't spend a large portion of what they earn, and that is a problem for the economy.
The traditional argument is that the rich, though, are more likely to invest it in the company or new jobs or whatever, more ripple effect. If it gets redistributed to the poor, yes, it'll pump money in the economy in terms of food and whatever, but it will have less ripple effect.
But you see, that reflects a basic misunderstanding of the economy. The CEOs and the wealthy are not job creators. The job creators are the people who buy, are the people, the customers. They are the ones who create incentives for a company to hire or to expand. Without customers, a company is not going to do that. So this is the great insight that Henry Ford had in 1913. He paid his workers three times the going rate, and that forced other fledgling car makers to do the same. And what did that mean? That meant that you had suddenly a lot of people who could afford to buy Model T Fords. And that meant that Ford could hire more people and expand. You see, the job creators are not at the top. The job creators are the middle class and the poor who spend their money and actually generate economic activity and more jobs.
You know, we've been hearing, of course, about the gap between rich and poor, ever since the Occupy movement with the 1%ers and 99%ers. But that's kind of cherry-picking the tails of the distribution. Do you know what the story is about income inequality at the 25th percentile versus the 75th percentile,
for
example?
Well, all of the rungs on the economic ladder are becoming somewhat further apart, and we know this. Mm. There have been a number of studies.
Mm, I didn't know that. Okay.
The middle rungs on the ladder are missing, because those used to be the old manufacturing jobs where, you know, you could get very well paid because unions were strong and you didn't need a lot of education. So those rungs are missing altogether. But the big new difference that we did not know about before is between the very top. I'm talking about the top 0.1% and everybody else. Because you see, and again, this recovery proves the point. Since 2009, when the so-called recovery began, 95% of all of the economic gains have gone to the top 1%.
Wow.
That means that everybody else...
Is there a dispute about that? That's a frightening statistic. Is there a dispute about that?
No. In fact, Emmanuel Saez was here at Berkeley, and Thomas Piketty, who's written that new book that's getting a lot of attention, Capitalism in the 21st Century, have done the calculations. They've looked at tax returns, and there's no question about that.
But they're your kindred spirits. If I had somebody from the Cato Institute here, the American Enterprise Institute, would they question that statistic?
Well, they haven't. They haven't been able to find holes in them.
Good. Just wanted to check.
Interesting. All of these issues are so polarized. And I want to emphasize to anybody who's listening, I am not a class warrior. I don't demonize the wealthy because they have wealth. In fact, I think just the opposite. We ought to congratulate people. Most people, you know, the problem is not that you have a few people who have wealth. The problem is that upward mobility is now so difficult for so many people.
Let's talk about the downward mobility. Let's talk about that middle for a minute, because that's frankly partially because people always listen to what's relevant to themselves, and it's the middle class, and you've talked about this a lot, the hollowing out of the middle class. You know, one of the major messages in both your book and in the movie is that redistribution is necessary. So if you do, in fact, raise the cost of hiring an American by raising taxes, even employer mandates like Obamacare, how much, in your honest judgment, you know, will that make employers more likely to hollow out the middle class more, to automate more jobs, to offshore more jobs? What's your take on that?
Well, you know, you've got to make poor people more productive. That is through education and job training and on-the-job job training, which is extraordinarily important. The more that employers view their employees as assets to be developed instead of as costs to be cut, the more competitive we're all going to be. The rising tide is going to lift all boats. In other words, this is not a zero-sum game, Marty. It's not as if, let's say, the top 1% would do better if the bottom 99% continued to do worse. It's just the reverse. Actually, the top 1% would do better if the economy was growing faster, which depends on the bottom 90%, 99% doing better. They would do better with a smaller share of a more rapidly growing economy than with a large share, as they now have, of an economy that's anemic, barely growing at all. And let me just add one other point to that, and that is when I talk about this kind of growth, some people, I think completely understandably, they say, well, we can't grow, it shouldn't grow more, we can't afford it environmentally, the energy costs, the environmental degradation, a company's growth is just going to be impossible for us to endure. we ought to live more simply. Mm-hmm. The response to that is that when I say growth, I'm not talking about consumerism. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about just filling our homes with more stuff.
Crap. Yeah.
I'm talking about all of the ways in which we improve our standard of living through education, through a better environment, a cleaner and more sustainable environment, investing in non-fossil-based fuels. That is a form of economic growth. That's why you find that the richest nations have the cleanest environments, because they can afford that. Public health, all of these things are possible if we utilize our capacities in a way that benefits more people.
What do you think about the idea that some of the consumer spending should be more on services, for example? All of us end up spending time on things that are perhaps not the highest and best use of our time. So, for example, I hire a personal assistant so I can be freed up to have the privilege of doing shows like this. If we created a culture in America which even blue-collar and barely middle-class people decided, you know, it is worth my offloading, hiring somebody to help my kid with his homework, to help me learn computer stuff, to do more of my crap work, might not create more jobs without the materialism and the environmental degradation that would accrue.
Well, that's already happening. The problem is the distribution of income and wealth is getting so skewed that the bottom half of America are barely making it. I mean, and two-thirds of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. They are not doing well. We're creating what might be called a new servant class. People who are in various low-wage healthcare occupations or retail workers or fast food workers, people who are cleaning houses, people who are childcare workers who are getting very, very little pay for what they're doing, or elder care workers. In other words, more and more of the life of the upper middle class and the rich are being outsourced to people who are not being paid nearly what they need.
Well, I know that one of your core beliefs is the minimum wage should be raised to a living wage, $15 an hour. But I'm already seeing that companies are investing big in roboticization. For example, those very fast food workers who are the most vulnerable, they are created, believe it or not, a Starbucks barista. That supposed fail-safe job, they've got automated baristas, which is going to kill thousands of jobs. You've got automated burger flippers, automated servers. They're doing it in Japan. Is not, if we can all on an emotional basis certainly say, of course, I don't want anybody making $10 an hour. You can't live on $10 an hour. But if we raise things 50% to $15 an hour, are we not going to make employers accelerate their desire to even say, to hell with them, we're going to use machines?
Employers are already doing it as fast as they can. Moving from $10 or $7.50, which is now the federal minimum wage, to $15 an hour is not going to accelerate the movement of employers. If they can save money, they're going to save money. The issue is to give people, just out of common decency, a minimum amount of money so that they can have some ability to be full and productive citizens and take care of their children. If they don't do this, if we don't have a minimum wage that is at least close to a living wage, then everybody is going to have to pay more in taxes to support food stamps and low-income housing and Medicaid for all the people who really are in poverty. We're going to have a larger and larger number of working poor. It may be old-fashioned, but honestly, if somebody's working full-time, they're not a teenager, they're a breadwinner for their family, I don't think they should be in poverty.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco, my special guest, Robert Reich. I could talk for an hour about what he's accomplished, but he's written 13 books and a movie called Inequality for All, and Aftershock is the book from which it is derived. You used an interesting word. I don't know if you actually use the word courtesy or not, but there is something charitable. If I am a completely bottom-line-oriented employer, I know that the impact of my being generous and training my workers in the larger cosmic scheme of things is trivial. It requires a certain kindness, a statement that says, I want to do my part. Even like, for example, if I'm a young person and I sign up for Obamacare, I know it's probably a lousy deal financially for me, but I'm feeling this larger social contract that I need to be obliged to. How realistic is it to ask employers to voluntarily do more job training, and how much of that is a role for mandate in your judgment?
Well, good question. I think that wise employers who are taking the long-term view are already treating their workers as assets to be developed. They are training their workers. They're providing health care for their workers. They're doing a lot. I know just off the top of my head, because I had breakfast there this morning, a restaurant here in Berkeley that treats its workers, pays them not only $15 an hour, but also health care and other pension benefits. And now you would think that that would be unprofitable. Actually, the turnover has been cut to almost zero. They keep their people there. And that low turnover has meant huge cost savings to that restaurant. So by taking the long-term view, businesses that, again, treat their workers as assets, those workers become assets.
Again, logically, it makes so much sense. But it recalls for me Owings Mills. Owings Mill was a company in Ohio, and they had a no-layoff policy, and they were going to have everybody full-time with benefits, and they ended up going out of business because the Chinese fabric companies just were so much cheaper, they couldn't afford it. What do you tell to this is not a robust economy. What do you tell to the business owner who is not flush with profits and doesn't have the luxury of worrying about long-term because they'll be out of business before we get to the long-term?
Well, look, manufacturing is a slightly different issue from service businesses. Manufacturing is coming back to the United States, but not the jobs are not coming back because the jobs can be done more cheaply elsewhere. And we're not going to be able to reinvent the world around a manufacturing-based economy. But in terms of service, and most of our jobs are local services, they are person-to-person services, they are, as I mentioned a moment ago, they're restaurants, they're other kinds of personal services. What we want to do is to make sure that people who are employed have at least a minimum degree of security and wages. And my point is that this is not and need not be a matter of charity. It's good for the business. Now, you say to me, well, but supposing the small business person can't take the long-term view, you know, is fighting for his or her life. I say back, even in the short term, it's going to save you money because your turnover costs, the retraining and turnover, are such a high portion of the cost of many, many small businesses. If you have employees who are loyal, who are looking out for ways of improving productivity, who are actually improving your relationships with customers, who are feeling that the business is part of their own business, that they use the we pronoun in terms of describing what they are doing every day. And that's a different kind of business. That's a successful business.
And I do think that the currency of the realm cannot just be dollars. The currency of the realm in the calculus that the bean counters use has got to include humanity. To what extent are you improving the lives of human beings? And at the risk of that sounding sanctimonious, I think if we all thought more loftily, isn't that maybe the foundational thing that needs to occur in our schools is to think cosmically, or am I being, again, too highfalutin?
Well, I think what we have to do in terms of education and in terms of social education is bring back what we called in my day citizenship education.
Right.
I mean, we're all citizens of the same society. We have certain obligations to one another as members of the same society. Now, it is hard for businesses, particularly large businesses, where you have investors and Wall Street breathing down your collective necks, and they are saying, we are looking at quarterly profits and losses. We don't care about year to year. We don't care, certainly don't care about 5 years. If you just have to meet your mark this quarter, well, those managers, those CEOs are under a great deal of pressure. But even those CEOs, I think, are making a mistake if they think that they can take $5 to $20 million a year out of that business, and their top chief operating officers can take another $5 and $10 or $20 million, and at the same time treat their bottom rung workers as if they are simply fungible pieces of material that can be flushed down the toilet. You can't run any organization with the kind of ratio between CEO pay and worker pay we have right now, which has never been this high.
I'm wondering if there's yet another rationale that might work. If, in fact, you know, right now all those big companies spend millions and millions of dollars on advertisements, publicity, all that crap. If instead they took half of their marketing PR budget and they simply reallocated it to more, let's say, quality of life treatment of their employees, treating people with dignity, their lower and middle level employees, and then spend a quarter of their PR budget on saying, look, what we want to be a national model. I would bet you would get more customer loyalty, you'd get more sales from pitching that than pitching the wonderful features and benefits of their widget.
Well, some companies do this, and they do treat their employees well, and they do talk about it. and look at the difference between Costco, for example, and Walmart. There is a big difference. But I think we also have to think about public policy. I mean, if a company like Walmart, pays so little that its employees, in order to avoid poverty, have got to be on the dole, have got to get Medicaid and got to get food stamps, well, we ought to bill as part of their corporate tax bill the cost of all that Medicaid and food stamps right back to Walmart.
The externalities. You've made mention three or four times now the word education, and I really liked, I got to tell you, your talk about on-the-job training. Last time we spoke, when you were on the show, I had asked you a question. I said, if you were the czar and you could make one edict to try to improve the job situation, you would say you more heavily fund Head Start. Unfortunately, since then, the Obama administration commissioned a meta-evaluation of all the studies of Head Start that had been done, and reluctantly, and they really withheld the study for a couple of years to be sure they couldn't somehow tweak it, but in fact, it has very, very little impact. I am, maybe because I'm, you know, to a hammer, everything's a nail, I'm a career counselor, I like to think that especially non-abstract thinkers will grow a lot more in thinking skills, employability skills, and everything with on-the-job training, but most on-the-job training has failed. So I want to propose something to you, Bob Reich, and you be tough on me. This is, if I were the czar, this is where I would put money in terms of training. It is impossible for a nation to have everybody get the best teacher. But there are a few transformative teachers who have the ability to connect with people and change them fundamentally. I would have the federal government fund the creation, for example. Let's say it is a customer service training thing or a how to, you know, to program or how to whatever it is, diversity training. And I would have a dream team of the most transformational instructors in America, lock them in a room with some computer geeks and create a highly immersive, interactive video, simulation-centric, and make that available free to every company. I like to think that there'd be more growth in not only the job-related skills, but overall human relation skills, etc., than if we try to say, oh, individual employee, you should do job training. What's your reaction?
I think that's a good idea. And again, we're moving in that direction in terms of more and more online job training. But I want to go back to something you said about Head Start because, you know, you're dealing with some of the most difficult kids in terms of their backgrounds and their lack of kind of developmental skills because they come out of families that have not had anything. You know, these kids have medical problems. They go to bed hungry. I know some of these, you know, when I was Secretary of Labor, these children. What we really do need to get very serious about, in addition to on-the-job training, Marty, is 0 to 5-year-old stimulative early childhood education, and even prenatal. I mean, I go back to prenatal. I mean, these brains, there's so much research showing that if you get to these brains early, if you stimulate them, if you have adults who are talking to these kids, these infants, they are going to do better in grade school. They're going to do better in high school. They're going to go on to college. They're going to commit fewer crimes. They're going to get less out-of-wedlock pregnancy. The data are there. This is absolutely clear.
Bob, this is the one, my dear Bob, if I can say that, this is the one area we're going to have to agree to disagree. My PhD is in the evaluation of education. I'm obsessed with it. My wife's a superintendent of school. She's actually quite nationally prominent. The data is more wishful thinking. The real good data on birth to five, it sounds good, but it really is not good data. There's a lot of data on rats that show some malleability and plasticity. There's some little pilot programs that have not proved to be generalizable. But when you look at the meta-evaluations of the data, we are placed too much faith in education relative to any kind of data that really exists. I can't agree with you.
Well, look, we can argue the data, but let me just say it's not just education 0 to 5. It's the health of these young children. You know, I've seen kids going to, at the age of 5, going to kindergarten, who have not had anything to eat for the neck for the left for 12 hours. They have tooth decay. They have vision problems. How in second or third grade can you learn to do anything if you can't see the blackboard, if you can't even read because nobody has diagnosed your vision problems? We've got to think of the education as part of a broader set of issues having to do with public health and the health of individual kids, and I'll agree to disagree with you about that if
okay.
you want
to. No argument there. You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My special guest is Robert Reich. He is the he's been an advisor to Bill Clinton, Secretary of Labor to Bill Clinton, and economic advisor to President Obama. He's the Chancellor's Professor of Public Policy, University of California, Berkeley, author of 13 books, including Beyond Outrage, The Work of Nations, and Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future, which is the basis of a movie in which Bob is the star, Equality for All. We've talked about unions very briefly. Let's dive a little deeper into the union thing. Certainly, that's one of the recommendations in the movie. Some people worry that unionized industries have been badly hurt, costing jobs. You look at steel or airlines or cars. And unionized fields like teaching are criticized for unions protecting burned-out teachers with such onerous due process that it's a poor use of principals' time to take the years of efforts to get rid of a bad teacher, and though the teachers continue to hurt kids year in and year out. What are your thoughts on how to increase unionization, which I understand there's a need in this current imbalance, while minimizing the negative side effects that unions sometimes have?
Well, there's several things we can do. First of all, start with low-wage workers in the private sector. Again, retail, restaurant, hotel, hospital, surface transportation, child care, elder care. You know, these workers are putting in huge amounts of time. They're getting almost nothing back.
Right.
They need to be unionized. And unions are not going to invite foreign competition because these are personal services. They've got to be done in person. Unions are not going to invite in robots because a lot of these things do require human beings to do them. Now, your second point, obviously there are abuses. I mean, we've got to, in education, in the public sector, we've got to make sure that unionized workers are accountable. We've got to make a deal with educators, with teachers. We'll pay more, and I think teachers are underpaid in many respects, particularly the good ones. We'll pay you more, but you have got to be more accountable. There's got to be a longer period of before you get tenure. You've got to have observers in the classroom. You've got to reach a high minimal level of competence before you get tenure, and then you are going to be paid for performance. But you are going to be paid well. If you perform well, you're going to be paid well.
So the macro issue is that we have been too capitulating to unions. The unions wield a fair amount of power with the media especially, and no employer wants to be seen as a union buster or anti-union. But is what you're really saying is, yes, we will compensate you appropriately and well, but there's got to be more emphasis on performance and less on job security.
Yes, well, but performance, pay, and job security all go together.
But
you're generalizing about unions a little bit, Marty. You know, in the private sector, if you go back to the 1950s, we had 35% of Americans in the private sector workforce who were unionized. And that many meant that even the non-unionized workers in the private sector were given pay packages that replicated essentially what the unionized workers were getting. You know, we had essentially prevailing wages and prevailing benefits across the nation. This is one reason that in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, and early 1970s, you had the middle class get as large and as prosperous as it did in the United States. But now in the private sector, you've got fewer than 7%.
Wow, down to 7. Wow.
Fewer than 7% of private sector workers are unionized. So when you talk about unions, the private sector is basically deunionized, and it's deunionizing like mad. So there is no bargaining power at all. Most people are individuals. They're on their own. They have no union to speak to them, to bargain for them, to bargain on their behalf. And one consequence is that you get median wages continue to drop, adjusted for inflation. The middle class is under great stress. It's in many respects it's shrinking. We have more and more working poor, people who are working full-time and yet in poverty. Well, that's not a good result.
You know, I'm noting the difference, for example, between General Motors and Tesla. General Motors, of course, is unionized. Tesla is not. And I can imagine that if I am a car company And it's a very global field. I mean, Toyota, I must admit, I'm not a brand loyal person to anything except Toyota, because they just last forever. I just love them. But they don't have a union. They've got this huge advantage. And American car makers, there's tremendous job security. They did pay very, very well with very fancy retirement plans for the workers as well. And if I'm a car manufacturer, I feel like I am having to fight with this worldwide battle against Toyota with one arm tied behind my back. What do you say to me if I am Wagner, who used to be, or the Mary Barra, the new president of GM?
Well, the question is, from the standpoint of not GM, but from the country, from the United States, do we want to be on a low road where we are competing ultimately on wages? And there, you know, there's no end to that low road. I mean, are we going to be competing with Bangladesh next?
The race to the bottom.
Or do we race to the top? In terms of productivity, in terms of, we've talked before about treating workers as assets, developing workers, on-the-job training, making people more and more and more productive as they work longer and harder, sharing productivity gains with workers, sharing profit gains with workers. You know, there are other ways of organizing this. If you're talking about the service sector of the economy, which is the real growing sector. That's where most of the new jobs are. There is not a union to be seen. Mm-hmm. Instead of GM being the largest employer in the United States, as was the case in the 1950s, with a typical GM worker earning the equivalent of $35 an hour today, the largest employer in the United States today is Walmart. And the typical Walmart worker is earning between $8 and 80 cents and $10.50.
I didn't realize it was that little.
Yeah, but because a lot of them are part-timers. That's one of the ways in which Walmart keeps their wages down. So this is an entirely different landscape in terms of who's employing whom and for what.
I want to turn to another area of work-related policy. The Obama administration's Department of Justice is investigating Kaplan, you know, the SAT prep company, for using credit records as a hiring criterion. And the government is concerned because it has a disparate impact on African Americans who don't have as good a credit record. And Kaplan says, on the other hand, that it has a big problem with employees stealing, and it's using credit checks as one way to try to choose employees who are less likely to steal. Where do you stand on the government's increased investigation of disparate impact?
Well, I think that if the overall impact is discriminatory, that is, if certain groups that have traditionally been affected by discrimination are affected in a disproportionate way by certain policies that are adopted by Kaplan or anybody else, then the government has a very good case. I mean, individual employers can say, oh, no, of course, you've got it wrong. I'm not discriminating. I'm just using a rational process here. But if the effect of that so-called rational process replicated over the economy is to intensify and replicate discrimination in this economy, then of course we've got to take a hard look at that.
I'm curious what you think about the price. If I own a candy store or whatever, or big enough so that I'm subject to government regulations, and I am not allowed to have selection criteria that have disparate impact, and it is primarily on African Americans. We all know, for example, the test of cognitive functioning have a disparate impact on African Americans, credit checks, criminal records, etc. Am I not then thereby forced to move merit to the back seat? And net, in terms of the overall economy that you're referring to, are we not going to have a less capable workforce, an economy that is not going to be able to be sustainable compared to countries in other worlds where merit is left closer to the front of the bus?
No. Under the laws, every employer can make a case of a bona fide occupational qualification. And that is a defense to a charge of discrimination. The question really is, in the aggregate, are certain kinds of practices? I mean, the analogy would be profiling somebody, stopping anybody who looks Latino and saying, get out of your car and we're going to search your car because you might be an undocumented worker here in the United States. Well, when you generalize to that extent on the basis of certain characteristics that really are not individualized, what you're doing then is perpetuating a set of prejudices and discriminations that hurt the economy. They don't help the economy. They hurt our society. They don't help the society. If an employer has a bona fide occupational qualification and a reason for saying this particular test is directly related to what I need in terms of my employer or employee, then, you know, that employer can get away with it, and that's perfectly legal. But if the government or anybody else can prove that that test is not absolutely necessary, that it has a disproportional impact on certain minority groups, and you as an employer can do, you have other ways of testing individuals without using this discriminatory test, well, then the law should not allow it.
Got to push back in two ways. First of all, the analogy to stopping people because they're Latino is not applicable here, because we're not talking about any selection based on race. It's a selection based on a job-related criterion. The problem with your argument, yes, an employer can defend if, in fact, there is a bona fide relationship between the selection criteria and a success on the job. But it is such an onerous task to defend that. You need to hire psychometricians and have long-term, for example, long-term longitudinal data about predictive validity that most employers, rather than face the ire of having to defend against the Department of Justice, say, to hell with it, I'm just going to only use criteria that don't have disparate impact, even if it results in less meritorious people. And I don't think that's good for society.
But I disagree with you, Mark. Okay. I think that the burden of proof, if you're actually having criteria that have a disparate impact, that actually make discrimination worse and in our society, make it harder for African Americans or for Latinos or for women or for anybody else to get ahead, then the burden of proof ought to be on the employer to justify that and to say, I have to have and I have to use that criterion. Otherwise, we're going to be in a society that just perpetuates these kinds of discriminations.
I think the largest good accrues when employers hire the best people.
But you're begging the question. The question is, who are the best people? I am under 5 feet tall.
Right.
If a basketball team made an advertisement, set out advertisements and said, we want people who are only over 6 feet tall, would I have grounds under any kind of labor law, even the Disabilities Act, would I have grounds to say to that employer, you are prejudiced against me and you are using the wrong criteria? Probably not, because the employer could come back and very easily convince almost any rational judge, if he ever got that far. I think the case would be thrown out before it ever reached the court, that you've got to have tall people to play basketball. Anybody under 5 feet tall is not a bona fide, that's not going to make it.
That you use the magic word easily. But in the case of most employment, it isn't as clear as you need to be tall. The ability, for example, the reason that Apple has created an iPhone is they've used a lot of people who are really very, very rigorous thinkers. And any measure of cognitive functioning, unfortunately, for societal reasons, whatever, have a disparate impact on African Americans. And to defend it, though, is not easy. You can't just say, look and say we need smart people. I am aware. I happen to know something about disparate impact. I did a whole show on it with some real expert lawyers on both sides. We had a debate. It cost millions.
You think Apple cannot afford to defend itself when Apple doesn't even know what to do with all its hundreds of millions, in fact, billions of dollars abroad? That is absurd. Apple can do anything it wants. Why shouldn't the onus and the responsibility be on a company like Apple to show why it is discriminating?
Bad example, Apple, because they're so flush with cash. But most companies, there are millions of companies in the United States, most of them do not have an extra million to defend. And my PhD is in evaluation of education. I know how hard it is to prove predictive validity.
But believe me, the biggest companies, if they actually want to use a particular test, they are going to make sure that there is a court precedent that says it is permissible to use that. If that test, even if it has a disparate impact, if that test has a bona fide relationship, a rational relationship to what those companies need. So there are going to be apples out there, Marty, who are going to do that work. The mom and pops, the small businesses, they don't have to worry about trying to go to court. That's already going to be settled. All I'm saying is that we want to live in a society in which the burden is on those big companies, and that's where really the burden is, to justify criteria that have a disparate impact in our society.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemeco. My guest is Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton and economic advisor to President Obama, and author of Aftershock, subtitled The Next Economy and America's Future. We're beginning to run out of time. Now, I promise you asked to be out of here in 45 minutes. It is 45. If you need to leave, great. If not, I'd love to talk to you about 10 more minutes. Is that possible?
Well, how about 5 more minutes? Because Thomas Piketty, who has this new book out about inequality,
right,
is giving a seminar very soon, and I promise to be over there.
You bet. Then I'm going to ask you just 2 quick questions. One is important. This is a luxury for me. I'm not going to ask you any more work questions, but it's something that I agree with you 1,000% about. The need for 100% publicly funded campaigns. I have this vision that feels so right, that all campaigns would be 2 weeks or 3 weeks long, that the TV stations or whatever and the websites would donate, you know, time for debate and for posting their records. But isn't the problem that the fox is watching the hen house? You've got the incumbents increase their risk of losing their seats if they can't raise money. Incumbents have a huge edge in fundraising. So while campaign finance reform is cosmically just, how, Bob Reich, can we make it realistic?
Well, first of all, we've got to reverse the Supreme Court's decisions in Citizens United and McCutcheon. I mean, money is not speech. Certainly big money is not speech. And corporations are not people.
I agree.
And we've got to, if it takes a constitutional amendment, so be it. Secondly, we've got to set up a system of public finance so that government is providing, let's say, $2 for every dollar of contribution coming from a small contributor, a smaller donor, in general elections. Not every election, but general elections, major general elections. And I think that that is absolutely critical. Otherwise, what's happening in this country is that you have an increasing amount of income and wealth going to a smaller and smaller group of people who are essentially using some of their wealth, not everybody, but I'm saying that enough of them are using some of their wealth to pollute and corrupt our political process. The rest of us are silenced. This is not free speech. This is not a democracy. We're moving toward an oligarchy.
What's next for Bob Reich? We were both talking off the air. We're both not kids anymore. We both really want to stay as vital as we can and in the game. What's next for Bob Reich?
Well, I'm always writing a book. It's a habit.
Yeah.
I can't get rid of it.
You know,
it's an addiction.
I understand.
So I have another book that I'm working on. And I love teaching, Marty. I love my students. Mm-hmm. I look forward to and Berkeley is a wonderful place to teach. Mm-hmm. And so writing and teaching are very essential to me. I'm not planning on any more documentaries. A fellow who was the director of Inequality for All, Jake Kornbluth, fabulous, young, very, very clever, genius. Mm-hmm. He and I are working on a series of short videos that are kind of explainers about economic and political reality. The only way to reach millennials is not through writing big books.
It's a video.
Really do. They use the internet, and videos, short videos that are clever enough can reach them.
That makes perfect sense to me. Well, it was a privilege having you on again on the show. Bob Reich, thank you so much for being a guest on Work with Marty Nemeco.
Well, Marty, thank you for having me.
Great. And again, his book is the one book we can't talk about all his books, but Beyond Outrage, The Work of Nations, and Aftershock, The Next Economy in America's Future. And because we're talking about video, he did create a very compelling movie called Inequality for All. Again, Bob Reich, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marty.
Okay. We've got a few minutes left, and so I want to share a few thoughts that I had that I didn't have time to. Frankly, I wanted to fill the hour with him, but he has to go, and I certainly respect that. So a couple of thoughts that I have that I thought I would share that maybe are synergistic with our discussion. I am taken by the impact of luck in life, who you're born to, and is it not the role of government and of nonprofits and individuals to try to neutralize at least some of the effect of luck on who you're born to? If I were born in East Palo Alto to poor crack-addicted parents, my die is fairly cast. If I am born to educated middle-class people who are well-adjusted and provide me an enriched environment, as well as probably good genes, my future is not preordained, but I sure have, you know, a big leg up. So while I'm not some wild liberal, I'm really wondering whether indeed Bob Reich's message of redistribution can be couched in the most cosmically ethical terms of all, which are that all of us as individuals and in nonprofits and in government through our taxation might be wise to feel good about redistributing some of our wealth, even if it was completely gotten in a completely legitimate way, to neutralize some of the effects of luck that we deserve no credit for, whom we are born to, was one reaction. Two, we talked about the uneven the uneven recovery. It really does seem bimodal. That's the fancy word for there are some who really did great and some who did lousy. People who are software engineers, who are brilliant, and who also have communication skills, so they're not just programmers whose jobs can be offshore to China or India, but who can communicate well and lead teams or whatever. They're doing fine. They're making six figures. There's all kinds of jobs. If you can program Ruby on Rails, all of that, life's good. But if you're a more normal person, you know, even if you are college educated, and these days we have more people graduating from college than ever in society, people who are your typical soft-skilled college graduate, let alone somebody who is, you know, quote, heaven forbid, below average, as Garrison Keillor said on Prairie Home Companion, half of us are by definition below average. I'm really, really worried about that bimodal recovery where the techies are going to do fine. What the hell are we going to do about that, quote, bottom half? I don't know. I think some of the answer was in training, not in the academic sphere, which is completely infelicitous and poorly matched to a lot of the people who are not brilliant. They are going to learn more on the job. And I do think that Bob Reich is really right in emphasizing the cosmic responsibility that employers have to do on-the-job training, both for the societal good, but maybe even he's right that a modest amount of investment in on-the-job training, even when the person, I mean, it's not, quote, cost-effective, may, at least in the medium term, help people, their employees, more loyal, make them better workers. I think that that may be an important answer for that, for the bottom half. Next point. Entrepreneurship education. I think that the only way we permanently create jobs is to create more ethical entrepreneurs. If we simply tax more, well, yes, some of what we're taxing are the rich or whatever. Remember that there's this nonprofit entity that's called the Tax Foundation. The top 5% already pay 57% of all income taxes. We take more, some of it is going to be eating our seed corn. There is going to be less opening up of a new branch of a store, less money on research and development. So I don't see that. But it seems to me that, you know, going to the well of the rich or even the upper middle class for too much just ain't going to have enough, not going to create enough jobs, especially for that bottom half. But it doesn't require astrophysics or the ability to parse out the data in big data and to create multiple regression formulas to be an entrepreneur, a simple entrepreneur. And Bob Reich and I were talking about, you know, kind of very simple service businesses. I think if we train people in our schools using immersive interactive video to learn the essence of entrepreneurship, which is identifying good, practical, ethical ideas and how, without spending a lot of money, becoming reasonably profitable, how to market, that can be taught to many more people. And I like to use the example of a simple business like dating, a dating coach. How many people, no matter in good times or bad, we want to hook up, whether it be for the night or for a lifetime? But many people who are going to put their ad on IQCupid or Match.com or eHarmony or JDate or whatever it is are scared. What am I really looking for? How should I describe myself? What pictures should I put on? And because relationship is so important, if they would be willing to pay somebody to guide them who's had a lot of experience in helping to create relationship ads. There's a good example of simple entrepreneurship that I don't think requires a PhD. And I think if we trained more entrepreneurs in the art of ethical entrepreneurship, coming up with ideas, creating a business plan that executes on it, marketing, cost control, fair pricing, customer service, all that stuff, I think that may be a way in which we can actually legitimately create sustainable, environmentally sustainable, and financially sustainable jobs for people who are not rocket scientists. unions. I think one of the most interesting takeaways from my interview with Robert Reich just a few minutes ago was about unions. There is something that does feel like there's an imbalance. There's too many employers who are treating workers like crap, paying them part-time, temp, no benefits, even universities. I'm sitting at the University of California, Berkeley right now, and I can't tell you how many professors, people with PhDs, get hired part-time temp to avoid paying benefits, or at least minimal benefits. There's something wrong about that, and there is something right about providing a little more unionization for folks. Because, again, I didn't realize how low it was. Reich said that maybe 50 years ago, 30% of all private sector workers were unionized. Now it's under 7%. I think we need more unions, but there is such a huge downside of unions that needs to be addressed, and I think Bob and I agreed about this, is that we need to pay people well, including job security and benefits, but we've gone too far to protecting people's jobs even when they're incompetent. I think that negotiators on management, whether it be in the public sector, as in like the teachers' unions, or in the private sector and companies, need to stand up to the media, because the media will always defend the unions. I think they need to be generous with the money and tougher on the accountability. So that, for example, teachers who may be fine for 2 or 3 or 5 years but burn out and then are hurting kids year after year after year, that the principal doesn't have to do such undue due process to try to get rid of them, that it's just not time effective when the union's lawyers are merely going to find some technicality some of the time to just get that teacher off. I think we need to stand up. We need to allow and encourage unions, but not allow them job security without true accountability in terms of quality of performance. And I was delighted to hear Bob deal with that. But all of that said, you know, all of this, I think it is a reality in a global economy and an economy where ever more technology is available, whether it be robotic making of burgers or drone delivery or all the jobs, you know, ATMs have cost millions of jobs. Automation ain't going away. It's going to happen. So I think the unvarnished reality is that we all have to learn to live on less. I think Bob Reich and I talked about that a little bit too. I think that the materialistic society, I think buying new Mercedeses versus old Toyotas or living in 3,000 square feet versus 1,500 in an okay neighborhood and wearing clothing that you bought used at Salvation Army rather than a new Facanable shirt from Nordstrom at $150 a pop, I suspect that humankind will be better if we are indeed less materialistic. And I think if we learn to live on less and realize that the road to happiness is not paved with designer labels, but paved with ethics, good relationships, creative outlet, whether it be music or it be writing or it be simply redecorating your place simply using a clever use of used bricks and boards, I think the world will be better. That's my best thought. Dear engineer, how much time do I have left so that I know what we've got? 4 minutes. Okay. So let me turn to another aspect of work that... let me talk about Bob Reich as the human being whom who I think you could tell I like. I really tried to maintain my kind of journalistic, polite skepticism and ask the hard questions I could. But I really like Bob Reich, and I think that there are reasons, and it's not like I'm as far left as he is. I'm not. I'm much more centrist than he is. But let's look at what career implications have. Bob Reich is one of the most successful people on the planet in terms of making a difference in the world, in terms of doing well in the media. So let's see what career lessons might exist. Oh, we're at 57 minutes. Okay, great. So we don't really have time. So I'll just simply say Bob Reich's willingness to engage in argument, but in a civil way, and his willingness, and he's in his 60s, to keep plugging for his ideals while being pragmatic where he could, is an inspiration for all of us. And that is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and all of you. Please join me again next Sunday for Work with Marty Nemko, every Sunday here on KELW from 11 a.m. to noon. Until then, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.